Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody. Welcome to the afternoon session. It's a tremendous pleasure to be here, and actually a little intimidating to be speaking at a conference where Werner Vogels gave the keynote from Amazon's AWS. So, I'm going to preface this by saying that this is not a marketing talk. I am now the CTO of Eucalyptus Systems Incorporated. That's a company that's all of about 4 months old, and it consists of myself and the people who authored the system, who are in my research group at UCSB. So, and hopefully over the course of the next hour or so, it'll become clear as to why it's a company and not a research project anymore. But this is mostly about what Eucalyptus does and not why you should buy it. Okay, so let's see. This is actually the beginning. And that's a strange thing. And you know, we work in cloud computing now, and we think cloud computing's been around forever. It's actually been around since Christoph Bisciglia talked to the media on October 8th of 2007. Right? That's not long ago. And if you are like myself and Narayan, and you've been doing grid computing for a while, grid computing's been around since about 1994, right? So to go from nothing to hysteria this quickly for distributed systems technology is new. I've been doing distributed systems a long time, and it sort of caught me and others off guard. And the reason I say that is because as soon as I started hearing about cloud computing, I started reading about it. And I went to the literature, the computer science literature, which is normally where I spend my time, and I didn't find anything, but I did find a lot of verbiage being generated out there in the blogosphere. And I was reading it, and it was, you know, referring in name to cloud computing, elastic computing, utility computing, these other kinds of computing, this computing, that computing, so on and so forth. And I didn't really understand much of what I was reading. Now, if you're a technical person and your job is to do research in distributed computing and a new computing paradigm comes along and you have no idea what it is people are talking about, it's a sign somebody needs to do some research. This slide I made last April, this is actually a slide from April of 2008. So, you know, figure four, what's that, 6 months, let's say, after the term had been coined. And if you did a search on Google at that time, as I did, you saw 527,000 such pronunciations about this thing that I didn't understand. If you do that today, actually this is probably about a week and a half old, it's 27 million. That's a huge amount of verbiage to be generated in such a short amount of time for a paradigm that I will submit at this point, most people know very little about, even today. Now, it's not been very long that we've been doing this, and so maybe that's okay, but that's a great deal of effort on people's part. And if you want to compare it to other things that people spend time talking about, Barack Obama is 77 million, and credit default swap is a mere 1.5 million. So if you use this, as I am, and I don't recommend this as a statistical method, but if you consider this to be sort of the zeitgeist, the way to take the pulse of what people are concerned about out there in Google space, which is, of course, where all knowledge resides, then this is a pretty important deal. And as a researcher, I thought, wow, okay, it's time to take a look at it. This is another thing that I noticed, which is that not only were people talking about it, they were spending money on it. This is a small, extraordinarily insufficient montage of logos belonging to companies that, as of last April, had announced cloud computing products. Now think about this, right? I mean, it's been 7 months. There's been a press release by someone from Google, who no longer works at Google now, actually. And we get, you know, all of that description and this kind of investment. And some of this investment is very substantial. And there isn't really, or there wasn't really, a firm understanding, at least on the part of academics, practicing academics, as to what it is we were talking about. Now that's a little alarming, right? At least to me, because it would seem to me that if we're going to, as a community, make an investment of that magnitude, right? That's billions of dollars up there, and it's worse today, it would be nice to know what it is we're investing in. Okay, so now I'm going to attempt, after having gone through the exercise of studying this and actually building an open source infrastructure that does this and then you know, developing the scars from people who wish to disagree with me, I'm going to try and do something very controversial and give you what it is that today most people mean when they say cloud. This is an epistemological definition. It's how dictionaries are defined. It's not what it is I want it to be. It's not the definition that's going to make me the most amount of money. It's when people use the term cloud computing, this is almost always, or most generally, what it is they mean. Okay, and it starts, let's say, at the bottom of the picture, with the observation that companies like Amazon.com and Google and eBay and other e-commerce based companies have tremendously powerful infrastructures in place today. This is reputed to be a picture of a data center that Google is building on the Columbia River Gorge in between Washington and Oregon. To give you some idea of scale, each of the buildings I'm pointing to there is 100 meters by 50 meters by four stories, and that's where the servers go. Right? The people don't go into those buildings very often. They actually work in the other two buildings. That is an awful lot of compute and storage and network power concentrated into two buildings. Google announced that they're building 25 of these sites worldwide as something called the Googleplex. They're not alone. Amazon builds data centers of this size. Yahoo builds data centers of this size. eBay builds data centers of this size. This is an awful lot of compute power. And it's on the Columbia River Gorge, by the way, because the conservative estimates for the power consumption are 120 megawatts just for the compute. There's a dam upstream that they need in order to power this. Okay, that's what large-scale infrastructure is going to look like to sell you things over the web for the next few years. What Amazon realized very cleverly is that through virtualization, through the ability to isolate people's usage of infrastructure through a combination of hardware and software technologies, they could rent out for a fee parts of that infrastructure. Okay? Amazon is really, really good at selling things on the web with very low margins, right? Werner this morning said, look, we sell things cheaply. What he's really telling you is that they have an infrastructure for selling you things automatically. There's zero touch, or their goal is zero touch between the time you click your credit card and the time the thing that you purchase is delivered to you. That's how they keep the margins low. The more they can automate the process associated with the sale, the cheaper it's going to be for them to sell you something. So they have very, very elaborate, powerful, sophisticated web services that front their e-commerce venue, their e-commerce infrastructure. Those web services could be used to conduct a rental transaction just as they are used today to conduct sales and rental transactions for things that are not infrastructure, like books and movies and digital cameras and everything else you buy on Amazon. All of that infrastructure could be used to sell you this good. It's just another good. Yes, it is a rental model, right? You pay for it, and then you stop paying for it, and your access to what it is that you are buying is time synchronized with those two events. That's not hard, right? I mean, that's not a big stretch for them, given that they do things with movies and so on and so forth. So they have this wonderful web service infrastructure which allows you access to this. It's very scalable. It's incredibly sophisticated. Okay, when you buy something from Amazon, there is a web page, typically, that tells you what it is you're buying. Let's think about a book. If you're buying a book, you've got a web page that says it's written by this author. It has this title. It's here's the publisher. Here's how many pages. It's hardback. That, unfortunately, is what today we call an SLA. It's telling you what level of service you're going to get from the book when you purchase it. Okay? If you're going to rent something from Amazon that isn't a book, you need something that's analogous, an SLA. It's really a quality of service specification, but QoS, for reasons that escape me, hasn't been attached to this particular notion in a cloud computing abstraction. So we'll call it an SLA. But all it is a description, perhaps in human-readable terms, perhaps not, of what it is that you are going to rent or buy from a set of web services. Okay? And then lastly, there are users. And the users consult the SLAs, make their selections, put in their credit card, and are delivered the goods. Now, another important feature that gets overlooked quite frequently is that that's transactional. When you buy a digital camera, they don't send you 40% of the parts and charge you 40% of the price. and then have you come back and purchase the other 60% and then go through some sort of assembly process. That would be confusing. Same thing with books. What if they sold you every other word and charged you half price? Not useful. What really makes cloud computing work, at least from an infrastructure as a service perspective, is that it is transactional. You put your credit card in and you get back the rental or not. Not partial failures, not, oh, in 3 hours we'll give it to you, but right now you can't have it. No, it's a transaction. And that has really driven the interest in this particular model of computing, beyond things like grid computing and other competitive models, very, very quickly. It's easy to understand. And the only way to reason about things happening at this scale is if they're transactional. That's cloud computing. And really, it is controversial to define it in that way because many companies now have a tremendous vested interest in going beyond that model, and that's okay. Cloud computing will become something very different than what I've just described to you, but today, that's what it is. All right, so if you untangle all of that and you come up with this is the model, immediately there's a ton of really important questions that you need to be able, or you want to be able to answer. The first question is, what applications are going to work well given the paradigm that I've just outlined for you, right? If you're a grid person, you know it's not all applications, right? When through the grid years, we discovered, sometimes painfully, that most things, that some things run really well in a grid and most things do not. There are just some applications that can't take advantage of the flexibility that the grid provides, that can't tolerate the latencies that are inherent in many grid systems. Other applications do that just fine, and for those applications, the grid is a perfect solution. I suspect the same thing is true for cloud computing. It is a paradigm. It is a model of distributed computing with a unique set of abstractions that must be programmed effectively in order to be able to have it deliver its promise. Just like any other distributed computing paradigm, some things are going to work well with this paradigm, some things are not. The question I immediately asked, or we immediately asked, is which things are going to work, and we don't know. Today we still don't know, right? I can give you a guess as to what things have been working, but what that set of applications is an unknown, is a question with an unknown answer. There are other things that popped up immediately as well. It's an automatic methodology. It's a methodology that is zero touch. The users, the people who interact with the cloud, are the ones who are essentially driving the entire experience without system administrators and actual administrators involved in the transactions. This, without the pay-as-you-go, without the credit card aspect of it, it seems to be useful in other settings. As soon as we started this project, chemists at UCSB came to us and said, wait a minute, let me get this straight. You can archive this ancient professor's software that he absolutely has to use every time he teaches this class and bring it back, and I don't have to be involved? Because like 30% of their time every quarter is reconstituting old software environments for us stodgy academics who refuse to upgrade to new ones. Yeah, that self-service provisioning, the idea that you can take the entire environment, all of the libraries, all of the data structures, all of the files, package them up and drop them into the storage system, unpackage them a year and a half later and have them be exactly as they were, it's a very attractive notion in places other than e-commerce settings. So what other settings is this useful for? We don't know. This legacy support notion, you don't hear people talking about this, right? If you go to Amazon site, they're not going to tell you about legacy support. Everybody's talking about a green field. But in point of fact, legacy support is a really, really big feature of cloud computing. And that sort of came out of this experience. So there's just a bunch of things that we think it might be useful for. And at the time we did this study, there was really no way to figure out whether we were right. And lastly, if you do want to look to the future, it's pretty clearly the case that aspects of cloud computing will be useful for all sorts of future IT infrastructure types of problems. And the one that caught our eye immediately is the data assimilation problem. Now, in my research group, in addition to distributed systems, we work on something called sensor nets. If you're not familiar with this, it's the idea that you can build very, very cheap, extremely disposable computers with really unreliable radios. They have almost no memory, they have almost no processing power, but they cost almost nothing. And the research question is, if I could do that, and I could scatter those things throughout the environment, what would happen? right? Now, if you listen to David Culler, what he says will happen is the first thing is everybody will become instrumented with these sensors. Your clothing will become instrumented. Your children will become instrumented. Your pets, your car, your refrigerator, your milk, everything. And those instruments, those things that are monitoring your environment, will then try to tell you something constantly, all at once. They will be raining data about your environment on you all the time. And the challenge, the big scientific computing challenge, is how do you make inferences from this data? It's very lossy. It comes at you with different periodicities. It must be time correlated in order for you to be able to do anything rational with it. It's moving, right? You're moving. It's moving. It's a really, really hard problem. It's not coming anytime soon. But I can promise you the infrastructure for it is not Google. Right? When you say, okay, so now I've got this huge data assimilation problem, how am I going to solve it? Everybody says, well, don't worry about it. Google has solved all of our data assimilation problems, and so we don't really have to think about this. No, that's actually not true. And the reason it's not true is because Google has a very, very different data model. When Google goes out and scrapes the web, it finds some pages that were generated 3 weeks ago, and it finds some pages that were generated 30 seconds ago. When you query the web, they're all presented to you as if they are the pages as of right now. Google throws away the notion of time. That's how they get scale. You cannot throw away the notion of time in data assimilation. Ergo, the data assimilation cloud is not something we've seen so far. Then what is it? How are we going to know what principles there are if Google and Amazon aren't going to build it for us anytime soon? We have no way of knowing. Other kinds of questions. This is what academics think about when they look at these kinds of things. Other kind of questions came up immediately. You're actually using a cloud daily. It's called your cell phone. It's got a standardized API, one of like three or four. It does a fixed number of things. There are services that you can get. You have no idea what happens behind the curtains. You don't know what infrastructure it's using. You don't know when that infrastructure is updated. All you care about is that you get a certain service from it, and that service you pay for. So when that cloud crashes into this cloud, great things are going to happen, but we don't really know what. So we thought, okay, great. That is absolutely something that distributed systems researchers should be thinking about. And in order for distributed systems researchers who actually build things to do, you know, for them to do any sort of thinking at all, they need an infrastructure. Right? We don't write papers and put down theories and equations. We actually build systems and observe what they do, and we do that using open source software because we have no money. So we thought, great, there should be an open source infrastructure that allows people to experience, play with, extend, and otherwise fold, spindle, and mutilate the concept of cloud computing so that we can understand this better. Right? This is clearly what's happened in other areas of systems work. We have been the beneficiaries of many of these systems ourselves. Much of my work has depended on open source components throughout my career. Somebody somewhere is going to have to build an open source cloud platform so that we can do this work. And we thought, you know, there's some really good reasons for people to want to do this. One, if this is so important, we would really like lots of other people to know about it. Right? We would like as many people as possible to become experts on this technology. We want to teach people about cloud so that when they go out into the world after their undergraduate education or perhaps their graduate education, they're able to use this new power effectively. We want to be able to just expand the community that has access to these technologies. You want to be able to identify useful innovations, figure out things that you want to do and things that you don't want to do. And really, as I was pointing out, there's a lot of hype around this, even today. And something that you can download from the web and pull apart and understand is really, really good at dispelling the hype. It is. It's in your hands. It's on your machine. You can see it. You can put a probe into it. You can run the debugger on it. It's yours. The hype sort of evaporates when that happens. So we thought, great, this is good. But one thing that we have to be very careful of is not to adopt an older technology and call it cloud computing. There's a lot of incentive for doing that, both on the research side. If your older technology is suddenly dubbed to be a cloud, you become a lot more fundable as a researcher. That's really what happens. You know, I'm not going to sugarcoat it for you. And so we saw a lot of our colleagues talking about their technologies, which last week were not clouds and this week were. So really, and then the commercial side of it. There's a lot of incentive on the commercial side. So what we thought was very key here was whatever it is that we get our hands on to do this investigation has to be developed from first principles to be a cloud. It can't be a refactored container technology. It can't be a refactored SOA technology. It really can't be a refactored grid technology. It's got to be something that was built from the ground up to be a cloud so that we can investigate these issues and know we're investigating the right issues. And lastly, if this thing existed, we thought, it would either be the Linux or the anti-Linux of our time. What do I mean? Well, if you're old enough to remember life before Linux, what you remember is that Unix existed, and there were several Unix vendors, and it was sort of proprietary, sort of not. There was an AT&T license, and this kind of fol-de-rol. And it was interesting to scientists, and computer scientists in particular. And then Linux came along and made exactly the same operating system, because Linux and Unix were really indistinguishable for a long time, interesting to everybody, particularly people in data centers. Okay, so what happened? The openness, the access to the technology, the exposure of what the abstractions were in Unix to the wide, wide world of open source developers really drove the technology forward. And so an open source cloud platform, if it is this important, could do the same thing. Or not. Or it could be that this really is smoke and mirrors, that there is no wizard behind the curtain, and that this is nothing more than a rehashed paradigm we've seen before, in which case we can all stop with the investments and the blogging and what have you and go on to do something more interesting. So we thought, okay, open source cloud infrastructure, good idea. And someone else clearly must have done this because really, you know, we're just not that smart. And the so we went out and we looked, and really combed the bushes, as it were, hoping to find an open source infrastructure that we could do sort of this higher level research with, and we didn't. There are things that are sort of in the space, and I'll tell you the ones that we considered. The first thing that we looked at was Globus Nimbus. Globus is a grid technology. It's been around a long time. I've worked on it myself. And I've worked with it for, you know, 15 years or whatever. And so we were very familiar with what Globus can and cannot do. And there's a group within the Globus community that had put essentially a bunch of web service-like wrappers around some Globus services to make them behave in a cloud-like way. And so we got that system, and we installed it and kind of went through an evaluation of it. And it does do cloud-like things. But it's not really a cloud. It shares many of the strengths and some of the weaknesses with grid computing because the internal technology and the way it is architected really come out of a different usage model. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. We actually had to figure out why that was because we thought this is the answer. But it turned out not to be. The next thing we considered is something called Anomalism. It's actually called ECP now. At the time, it was called Anomalism 2.0. This is an open source company, a small company out of Canada. And what they had done is built a Java-based framework that allowed you to do very basic cloud stuff. And then they would sell, as their business model, plugins to enhance the functionality. So there's two things about that, or three things about that, that we found weren't quite what we were looking for. The first is it's a refactored data center control technology. There's a lot of companies that had made sort of control consoles for either controlling virtualization or for controlling networks or whatever, out of Java primarily, a lot of these companies. And those companies were refactoring their technologies to be more cloud-like. So it certainly has that property. Java as a systems programming infrastructure is a huge challenge when it comes to configuration management. It is write once, run everywhere, as long as there are no devices involved. As soon as devices are involved, it's write once, run nowhere, because you have to do the device integration. And so there are some issues there. These guys have been working on it. I actually gave a talk a couple weeks back where some members of Anomalism were in the audience, and I said erroneously that I hadn't heard from them in a while. I heard from them very quickly after that. They are selling Anomalism today. If you're interested in Java-based technologies, you should check them out. The plug-in architectures, our strengths or weaknesses, depending on what you're interested in, by all means, look at anomalism. But it wasn't this. It wasn't this thing that was designed from first principles to be a bunch of web services that implement very scalable transactional resource access. So the last thing we looked at is a project called Reservoir. There's actually a data center virtualization technology called Open Nebula that was done in Europe, and they've built a cloud research project, a multi-country cloud research project around Open Nebula called Reservoir. And if you read the documentation, everything in that documentation, if it comes to fruition, will generate a cloud and then some. But at the time we were doing this, and in fact today, the only software you can really get your hands on is Open Nebula. And Open Nebula, as a data center virtualization technology, has cloud-like features, but again, it just doesn't allow you to do this experimentation. So we said, all right, if we can't really go out and steal it, we're going to have to build it. And so the first thing we did was come up with a name, because that's what you got to do. The first thing we did was 4 months of design, and then we came up with the name. I wasn't sure this was a good research project, and when you have students' futures depending on your decisions, it's really important to understand whether there's research there or not. It took a while for me to convince myself of that, but we had. UC Santa Barbara is located on the beach, and there are about 7 or 8 palm trees strategically located for photographic purposes, but the rest of the campus is covered with eucalyptus trees, as is most of coastal California. And so it seemed natural to one of us at some point to call the system eucalyptus. My contribution, of course, was to recognize that systems are acronyms, not words, and that eucalyptus clearly stood for elastic utility computing architecture, linking your programs to useful systems. I've been banned from naming things in the UK for 5 years as a result of that effort, but I take that as a compliment. And what it is a bunch of open source web service components that have been stitched together to make a cloud out of whatever resources you have on hand, right? I am a researcher. I buy bargain basement machines and I keep them for 10 years. That has to become a cloud. You're a chemist. You just got a grant funded. You want to experiment with it. That has to become a cloud. You're a small business. You have got a bunch of racks of stuff from 3 different technology life cycles. That has to become a cloud. And it's got to become a cloud using open source components that can be downloaded from the web. That was what we did. But as I said, it's controversial to define what a cloud is. And when we were doing this, we thought this was vitally important. And so we thought, okay, first thing we're going to do is we're going to get involved in a discussion, a rational discussion with our learned colleagues about what a cloud is and is not. And I tried this for like 3 months. And while I couldn't figure out what a cloud was, the end of each conversation I had was, Rich, whatever you're doing, it's not a cloud. So this was entertaining but not productive, and we realized after a while that it was not going to be possible to argue for our software being a cloud effectively in an academically rigorous way. So instead, we decided to borrow something from the idea of a Turing test and say, well, we know that there is at least one cloud, and that's Amazon's AWS, right? It is indisputably the case that AWS is a cloud. We can argue about whether Google is a cloud. We can argue about whether the stuff that's going on at Terramark is a cloud. But at the time, it was the cloud. And so we thought, we're going to build this infrastructure out of web services. That's what Amazon's built out of. If we can support the AWS APIs to the point where a user or a program cannot tell the difference between Amazon and what we have built at least one cloud. At that moment, I can write a paper saying this is a cloud and no one can dispute that. So we did that. We said, okay, it's really cool. Amazon documents their APIs very, very carefully. They do so because they want to supply you with the infrastructure and they want an ecosystem of tooling, which Werner talked about earlier this morning, to build up around that very basic, scalable, low-margin service. Right? That's how they make money. That's how they make money selling things, even. So they had to document very, very carefully how their APIs work so that those of us who wish to use AWS could see what it is that we would get when we exercise their functionality. It just turns out that you can also implement the other side of that API, which is what we did. So we've done that. We are academics, and in an academic environment, it is absolutely, positively not possible to get people to change anything in their infrastructure for your research. If I buy machines, I can make them do whatever I want. But if I go to the department, if I go to the system administration staff at UCSB, which I did, and say, hi, I'm here to help you by installing this research-grade software project that might destabilize the 150 machines that the students use every day, they say no. If you're going to do this and you want to generate uptake, there has to be a way for whatever it is that you provide to people to function as an overlay, which means it has to land on the hardware and software it finds and treat that as inviolate, particularly with respect to the security policies. So Eucalyptus has a mode where you download it from the web, you stand it up on your machine, it doesn't touch your DHCP, it doesn't touch IP tables, it doesn't touch your network, it doesn't require any special privileges, and it will work. You don't get all the features. It actually turns out that Amazon's network provisioning semantics require more privilege than you can do as an unprivileged user on a Linux system. But if you turn those functions off, if you say, I want the trusted version, it will run as an overlay. This is critical, absolutely critical to open source projects when they first start, especially if it's a platform, if it's something you want to get other people to use, because you just won't develop the trust associated with it. And we knew this. We knew this because we've been trying to install grid software at UCSB for 2.5 years. And we could get it running on MyLab, but as soon as I would go to anybody's system administrator and say, we need to upgrade your kernel, and we need to change this Java library, and we need to, no, that libc's not going to work, boom, you're done, right? That goes on the back burner. So overlay mode's very important. And the thing that we also understood, and this is, again, from our grid experience, the first set of people that you have to get on your side when you're developing a new technology are the system administrators and not the users. Now, really, I went through the grid design wars, and I did this for NSF. We knew we had technology that our users were going to be really, really interested in using someday. But it was so painful to install and maintain for the system administration staff that at the end of the first week of any grid deployment, there was this cadre of enemies who actually had root, who made it their business to get your software off their systems. Made it their business. I built this system called the Network Weather Service, and I thought I was a genius because it would do all this fabulous stuff, but it was very difficult to configure and maintain. And people would write me hate mail about how bad it was. And I realized about halfway through the project, no one's ever going to run this. No user's ever going to see this technology because there are all these system administrators out there who hate me. So I don't hate them. We've learned. And Eucalyptus recognizes that system administrators are people, important people in this process. And so it tries to be as Linux-friendly in its installation and its maintenance as we could make it, given that it's a distributed system, which is a bit of a trick. Okay, so that's what we think we've done. And here are the goals. We wanted to foster greater understanding of cloud computing. We wanted this very, very soon after we did it. Again, these chemists seem to be the intrepid ones. They were like, look, we're thinking about using Amazon. We are. But we don't want to make an investment in Amazon. And we certainly don't want to port our codes to Amazon's compilers and all that kind of stuff until we know whether this works. Can we run this in our environment as sort of a preview? Yes. Yes, you can. The cloud actually demands quite a bit in terms of storage abstractions. And if you want to port your codes to those abstractions, you actually need a development environment. And so very, very soon after we started the project, people were using it for this purpose. Another purpose that sort of jumped out at us is there are lots of people who want to use their infrastructure and Amazon together. There are some businesses like Animoto who are, you know, 7 or 8 I envision them as being sort of young entrepreneurs sitting in a coffee shop with their laptops running a multi-million dollar business. That doesn't happen every day, right? What does happen every day is companies have some amount of IT infrastructure. They would like to get more IT infrastructure. They're debating on whether they should buy some more, they should rent some more, they should colo. There's all these options. What you can do with eucalyptus and what people have done with it and did from the start is make their environment look like AWS. So things move back and forth. You can run images in Amazon. You can move them to your eucalyptus cluster. They will work. If you use the right kernels, you can move things from eucalyptus into Amazon. It will work. Your applications use the same storage abstractions. They move seamlessly. You can do disaster recovery. You can do failover, so on and so forth. So this idea of homogenizing or bringing the cloud into your data center or pushing your data center out in the cloud, however you want to look at it, really was a very popular idea from the beginning. We talked about the Linux experience. We were hoping that this was just going to be cool. What it's not, though, and what it never will be and was never designed to be, is a replacement for AWS. It's not. We get this all the time, especially from people in other countries. They literally call us and they say, oh, thank you so much for doing this. We've downloaded your software, and now we're going to compete with Amazon. Forget that. That's funny, right? First off, there are an army, literally, of people who are responsible for the care and feeding of AWS. Right? Werner talked about it. He had a diagram. He said one web page in Amazon is 200 separate web properties, and each property has a small team of people responsible for it. What is that, 1,000 people doing one web page? Those people are responsible for that infrastructure, and then there's the people who are actually doing operations. This is a big organization making, and the reason it's big is because if you want to do this at that scale, if you want data centers that require their own power plants, right, and you want 25 of them, you're not going to download the software from the web. You're not. Exactly, right? I mean, you know, so we talk to these people, and often their English is so-so, and we say, please, go forth, try it. When you listen to me, it's not a replacement for AWS. It is something that does what AWS does, but it does it with your infrastructure, right? Amazon has designed its software to work not only with hardware that it buys, and has a roadmap for buying for years, but with the policies and the topology and the security mechanisms all built into their data centers. Eucalyptus is built to come to you as a tarball, right? So that you can take it, drop it on what you've got, preserve your policies, preserve your mechanisms, preserve your infrastructure, and make it behave like Amazon. And what you give up is global scale, right? It's not going to function at that scale. Okay, so if you're going to do this, if you're going to take on the idea that you're going to develop, using your graduate students, something that has the power, or potentially the power, to move the community towards a new paradigm, there's a bunch of requirements. And if I had known these were the requirements to begin with, I would not be speaking to you today. I would be happily enjoying tenure. So. They are that you must absolutely positively implement the cloud abstractions as people agree to them and not the ones you want. It's easy to implement something. It's hard to implement exactly what it is that these applications use. They have very specific semantics. The semantics are not bad. They're designed for scale. People look at the Amazon APIs and they go, oh, yeah, they're trying to do this for lock-in. No, they're doing it because they know they can scale it. And when you make changes, and we've seen lots of people make API changes to the Amazon stuff, almost invariably you're reducing the scale with which it can be implemented. So you must implement those abstractions correctly. It's got to be simple. Our stuff is based on web services, open source web services. All of the internal APIs are described by WSDL. It's not as simple as we would like it internally, but it's simpler than something that you can't see into. It has to be scalable. It does no good to build something that works great on one machine or a small collection of machines. The problems that you want to investigate happen at scale, so the experimental infrastructure has to be scalable. You've got to be able to modify it. We talked about non-invasiveness. It's got to be system portable. Today, the operating system, the hypervisor, the libraries, the password files, the security policies are all part of the infrastructure. You cannot mandate that those change if you want to drop a new software platform into someone's data center. You can ask them to buy something new in their next life cycle, but that's different. And configurable. While it's very possible to make software tools that drop onto your system and work, if it's a single machine, data centers have professionals, typically, that are spending an awful lot of time thinking about configuration, about how things are wired together, about where the security checkpoints are going to be. That's all stuff that is not embodied in the software. It doesn't come out of the Linux distro. It is installed by the local site personnel. And so your cloud platform must be able to adopt whatever configuration it finds, hopefully as automatically as possible, without perturbing the system administration staff. Just to give you an example, one of the complaints that people have about Eucalyptus is that you have to tell it about what IP addresses it's entitled to use. This is not because we don't know how to do this. We actually built a little gadget that would go out and scan the environment around which you were standing up a Eucalyptus cluster to figure out what the unused IP addresses were. And many of the people in my group are really, really good hackers. One of the guys has actually won DEF CON. Right? The very first thing that happened is the system administration staff from the campus came through my door and said, stop hacking our network. We're disabling all of your network access. And that's because what we were doing looked very much like an attack. You can do this stuff, but you shouldn't. You should allow the system administration staff, when it's setting this stuff up, to specify the configuration, and your system has to ingest that configuration as gently as it can to avoid these kinds of conflicts. And lastly, it has to be easy, right? None of this is any good if it takes a bunch of rocket scientists to get it working. So, another thing I'm going to borrow from my grid colleagues is to tell you a little bit about what you got to do technically. So, you need an architecture. Simple is good. Simple scales, and it's transparent. You need to worry about APIs, and I'll tell you what we did there. As Werner was saying this morning, the really, really tricky part here is the networking. And it's tricky for two reasons. One, hypervisors don't know anything about networks. They know about memories and CPUs. And they know a little bit about disks. Very little. So if you get a bunch of hypervisors and you put them in your data center, you do not have a cloud. And you do not have a cloud because you have no control over what's going on with the networking. You must virtualize the network. Right? When you virtualize the machines and you virtualize the disk, and that all has to be done as a transaction, and hypervisors give you one of the three pieces you need. The other pieces you got to roll yourself. It's got to be secure. Here we use WS Security so that the internal components of Eucalyptus, the web service components, authenticate to each other and can be made using a WS Security policy to encrypt the traffic. Currently, we do not encrypt the traffic. It's very expensive. We think that it's okay for people to see the requests that are going on inside the cloud, and we anonymize those requests as much as possible. But you can't connect to a Eucalyptus cloud and fool it into thinking that you are one of its components without having the keys necessary to do that. But we're using an open source implementation, and so it's as secure as that implementation is. And then there's a lot of packaging, installation, and maintenance work that you got to do in order to get this to work. I said the architecture was simple, and here it is. It's a layered architecture. It's tiered. At the very top, there is a thing that understands how to take SOAP or REST and turn it into an internal representation of the abstractions that clouds support. That internal representation for us is written in Java. So the next layer down, those are Java components. It doesn't have to be, but the object-oriented model is nice, and a lot of web service, there's a lot of web service technology out there for Java, so we chose Java. And so what happens is we can take an API, like the AWS API, and translate it to these internal objects. We have done other APIs. Another company came to us and asked us if we would do their API. We did it. We reported back to them. We were all ready to get it going, and then they changed it because they discovered, as we had, that there's some value in the Amazon API. But anyway, you can do lots of APIs this way. It's modularized away. On the left side, and then the system sort of bifurcates. On the left side is the VM control stuff, the stuff that stands up instances, tears down instances, attaches disks, so on and so forth. When you make a machine, you sort of go through the left side of Eucalyptus. That's called the cloud controller because we didn't do storage at first. And on the right side, there's the whole storage management thing. Amazon has this notion of S3, which is a eventually consistent put-get kind of storage, not a file system. But it's very, very scalable. And you can do bucket replication. It's just a good idea. And so so when you make requests to Eucalyptus, you're either making S3 requests or you're making EC2 requests, or sometimes you're doing both because Amazon and us keep the images, the actual images that you're going to stand up, in S3. So there has to be some interaction, and that interaction is both to deliver the images to where they're going to be run, and also to do all the authentication and encryption and MD5 checksumming to make sure that you're not getting spoofed by someone else's image. So all of that stuff needs to be implemented, and we do it, and that's what the database is for. The database really manages credentials. Okay, the bottom half is resource management, and what happens there is it does not scale to have any one entity in your system know where everything is, right? If you've got to take a picture of where everything is and bring it up to a scheduler, that scheduler can't make a scheduling decision until all that information is delivered. And then when it makes a scheduling decision, the request for that schedule event has to go down, and everything else essentially has to wait. Data center virtualization technologies work this way. Clouds do not. So if you want to do cloud resource management, it has to be way more scalable, or way more scalable than any centralized service can do. We use eventual consistency and a conservative approach in two levels. The top level, the cluster controller understands capacity and placement within its region of the cloud. And the bottom level, the node controller actually is responsible for putting things on nodes, taking things off nodes, attaching storage volumes, so on and so forth. And then there's some inter-cluster communication. This is built for a research environment where typically you have a head node that routes to the outside world and then a bunch of worker nodes which sit behind a NAT. That's because IP addresses are very expensive and scarce typically. We actually build tunnels so that you can have cloud allocations that span NATs. And that goes through the cluster controller. And then also, the Amazon network semantics have both a private IP and a public IP address assigned to the same network card. Each VM has one NIC, and so you got to pull off some routing tricks, and that happens as at both the node controller and at the cluster controller level. So we've tried to distribute the load associated with implementing the abstractions and build as scalable a hierarchical system as we can for Eucalyptus. All right. So now what I thought I would do, that's what it is, and that's what we've done and why we did it. Now what I thought I would do is talk a little bit about what we've learned. So here's some anecdotes. This is anecdotal information from the user community, the open source user community. If you do an open source project like this, people want to tell you stuff a lot. They want to tell you at 4 o'clock in the morning, and often you don't really understand what they're trying to tell you, so this is kind of a condensation of the things they've tried to tell us. The first thing that really comes through is that this notion of private clouds, the idea of having a cloud that you're going to put on your resources and you're just going to disconnect from the real world, that doesn't really exist many places. It does in very classified settings, right? There are three-letter agencies that have data centers that have concrete between, you know, the internet and the edge of their data center. But almost all systems out there today that are being deployed as private clouds are really trying to implement some sort of hybridization, some sort of amalgamation of the on-premise infrastructure that they have with some off-premise infrastructure, be it a colo or a public cloud or you know, Salesforce.com, a software as a service venue, something. And so really, the future is hybrid clouds. That's really what's going to happen. Werner very optimistically believes people will stop buying infrastructure. You know, my company owns a PBX. It's a 12-person company. Why do we own phone equipment when the phone company has been giving us phone service for 1,000 years? The answer is because you need some configuration on-premise. Do I own an entire phone company in there? No. There's going to be some infrastructure on-premise that you're going to compute on, and then you're going to get some stuff from your utility. And making that work together is what the future is about. Second thing that we learned is that while you can make virtual machine control into a commodity all you want, storage is really hard to do this way. Companies and research projects embed in their storage architecture the institutional knowledge that surrounds their persistent data. That's really the right way to look at it. You put things in directories, and you put those directories in places because of what time it is, who you're working for, how important that data is. The policy is embedded in the storage architecture. So while you can change the compute and you can change the network, it's really hard to change the storage architecture. So if you're going to do this, that's the part that has to be very flexible. That's the part that has to be able to mold itself to what it finds, because there's just no way that's going to change. We talk an awful lot, or we were talking an awful lot about cloud federation, this idea that we're going to have two clouds, and we want them to be under the control of a third cloud. This is a wonderful idea, and if you're not familiar with the term federation, what it means is that local control supersedes global control, but that there is some overarching global control mechanism. We did this in the grid. When we built the grid, right in the design meetings in 1995, we said it's a federated system, and everything that the user has to do has to be able to control this federation. This is a really bad idea. Right? And it's a bad idea because in order to mediate between two different policies in federated systems, you need a way to do matching. And that matching problem can't be solved automatically. It just can't. It's a multidimensional similarity problem, and there are no units of measure. So what we would do is we would go to our friends at SDSC, and we would deploy this really, really wonderful federated system within SDSC, and then we'd want to use resources at NCSA, which is another NSF supercomputer center. And the answer was absolutely not. No way. You haven't done the policy mediations. It doesn't carry this parameter. There's no way for us to temporarily give you access to these resources. Forget it. Policy mediation is a thorny problem. It's a thorny problem in the internet. This whole business about gateways and which gateway is dropping your packets, that's a policy mediation problem in a federated system. The gateways are federated, and there's no real way to look inside and see which policy is incompatible with your SLA. So don't look for federation in this space anytime soon. The cloud people are smarter than we were in the grid. They figured this out. They're talking about interoperability, which is the idea that there are protocols that allow completely distinct systems to interact. That will happen, but we won't see a federated system. And lastly, and this is purely a computer science observation, the really, really new thing, if you really want to point at something that has never existed before in cloud space, because a lot of these issues have existed in other systems, just never all together in one place. But the new thing here is that applications can reason about the dollar cost associated with their own execution. That's brand new. You could not, before a cloud, write a program that said, if I service this request, it will cost my user a dime. And now you can. You know exactly what the dollar cost is with that volume access, with this put, with that HTTP request. Now, is that useful? I don't know. It's probably the case that you can cut costs if your applications can reason about whether they should be spending your money. Then again, your employees have a hard time sometimes reasoning about whether they should be spending your money. And if your employees can't do it, it's hard to make a computer program do it. So it's not clear that this is something that's an important innovation, but it's absolutely an innovation. Okay. And then the other thing I wanted to do, those are some observations. Here's some myths. Anytime something new happens that people don't understand very well, mythology occurs. And we've heard a lot of it. And this is good. This is good. People are using their imagination about what is going on. But then you sort of have to look behind the covers and see how much of that imagination is actually accurate. So here are three myths that we hear a lot. The first is, look, this is nothing more than virtualization. I'm already running virtualization in my data center. I'm running a cloud. That's not true. The second myth, which came out of discussions that I had with many of my colleagues, is that clouds are really just grids. If you read the grid book, you know, you'll see that we talked about all of this stuff in 1997, and this is just nothing more than a refactorization of that technology. That's not true. And then the last thing which came out of the scientific users is, you know, I can't use cloud computing because the performance penalty is just so striking. And that's not true. Okay, here we go. Myth dispelled number one, clouds and virtualization. So the first thing to understand about virtualization is that it's a very powerful tool, so powerful that it plays two different roles in the data center, right? When you do data center virtualization, what you're really doing is providing a virtual environment that allows you to move what looks like a server from one hardware platform to another. We can talk about why you want to move it. There's all sorts of reasons, but that's what it does. Okay? But it's a server. It's an aggregated set of state updates. I have a server in my lab. It's called Pompone because one of my employees is Italian. That server today looks nothing like it looked a year ago, but it's still Pompone. There's an identity, and that identity must be preserved going forward in time, and data center virtualization does that preservation. Clouds do not work this way. the cloud image, the root file system, is not persistent. And that's because if you clone it, right, if you do a bunch of state updates and then you clone it and then someone makes some state updates but other people make state updates over here, you don't really know where the server went. Is it Pompone 1 and Pompone 2? If it is, you're going to have really, really big digits behind that. So these guys have thought about this. The cloud keeps persistent data in volumes, either EBS volumes or things that are these put-get volumes, so that you manage it explicitly, and that's to get away from this notion of implicit update to the state. Data center virtualization does not do this. We talked about the idea that there's more to it than just the VMs, and a lot of data center virtualization technologies are really hypervisor technologies, although they're starting to work on the network and so on and so forth. But here's the really big difference, and this is just a cartoon. In a data center virtualization context, there's one user. It's a system administrator. And that system administrator uses some very sophisticated tools to control the applications and resources in the data center. And so a request goes from the system administrator to start up a VM. And then an answer comes back and says, OK, I've started up the VM. And then the system administrator says, please install these libraries. And those libraries get installed. And the system administrator says, launch this application. And the application gets launched. Notice, there's one system administrator, and those requests go in sequentially. In a cloud, there are millions of system administrators, and they're all making requests of the cloud simultaneously. It's not the same technology, right? This is basically what happens when you do airline reservations. This is what happens when you build a Java front end to a hypervisor. Really, really different levels of scale. Also really different consistency semantics. Notice, here, I can draw you a picture of what's going on in your cloud. I can say, oh, here's where the VMs are, and here's where the VMs are not. You have three machines that have no VMs on them. Here you can't. Why? Because if I take a picture of those machines, one of those requests will almost assuredly come in and change the picture before I can deliver it to you. There is no picture of what's going on in the cloud. That's very unsatisfying if you're a system administrator. I understand. You can get an approximate picture, right? I can say, 30 seconds ago when I looked, this is what it looked like. But you have to be prepared for the idea that if you're going to operate at this scale, if you're going to have lots and lots of people making provisioning requests that drill all the way through to the infrastructure, and you're not going to service those requests one at a time, the picture you're going to get is inconsistent. Eventual consistency. That's the name of the game here with state management. And it's the name of the game in the cloud itself. This is really different than data center virtualization. OK, clouds versus grids. Myth number two. Here's the observations that I'll make. Werner made a very, very good observation this morning. He said, you know, we didn't do grids because it would mandate that everybody use the same software layer. You could argue with that, but I think that's valid. But here's my take on it, right? When we did the grid, we made two really important fundamental assumptions at the beginning. One was this federation notion. It was going to be federated. And we made that requirement for the following reason. The grid was built to handle the case where a single user could not get enough resource from any one site to run a problem of sufficient size. We built it for scientists. There are scientists all over this country and all over the world who have problems that are so big, so computationally large, either in terms of storage or compute or both, that no supercomputer center in the country can run them. Okay? So the idea that we had was that all of the supercomputer centers, there are about 30 sites at the moment, will run some kind of federated environment, and a scientist with sufficient privilege could sit down at any one of those centers at a terminal and get resources from all of them. One user given all the resources. There is no way, no way Amazon is going to commit all of its resources to one user, ever. Right? It's not architected for that. It's not built to be a single user system. It's not a federated system. In fact, there's no way for Amazon to give any user a substantial fraction of its infrastructure. Why? Because a lot of their capacity planning is predicated on knowing what the workload fluctuation is going to be. It's very difficult to predict what an individual user will present. It's not difficult to predict how many users you're going to have. So today, when you go to Amazon and you sign up, you get infinite scale up to 20 VMs. Right? every one of their users, with some exceptions, you can request more, but their users today are given a 20 VM limit. And that way, you can count users. 20 VMs is nothing, right? So as long as I know how big the user community is going to be from day to day, I know how many resources to provision, and I will never run out of resources. If every user was given, oh, say, all of the VMs as a potential limit, there would be conflicts. Somebody would not get their request service. You would not have this illusion of infinite scale. It would be a batch system. Grids are built for very, very large scale resource usage by a small number of users. Clouds are built for very, very large resource usage by a large number of users. Hundreds of teams, where each team is a very, very small number of people, can each get a tiny piece of the cloud. The cloud has to do all of that. That's really different from a grid. They are architected for different usage scenarios. The policies, the scalability, the performance is really different on those two ends of the spectrum. They're not the same. Lastly, how fast? Right? We're just hearing no end of complaints about how slow it was to run scientific applications in the cloud. Oh gosh, you know, I ported my code, it took me 4 months, and it's just running really, really slowly. And we kept scratching our heads over this. We kept saying, look, you know, something's not right here. I mean, yeah, it's for web services, that's what people are using it for, but come on, how hard could this be? So we did this very extensive benchmarking study. We took some machines, and we spent literally 5 months carefully setting all of the parameters and the tuning and the installation to be as the same as we could, so we could do a comparison study. And this was very, very painstaking. And what we found after just taking a really, really careful look at it, I will summarize as follows. When we did this study, random file access had about a 20% penalty. No other activity in a virtualized system, cloud or otherwise, had any statistically measurable difference except for CPU activity, which sometimes was faster on a virtualized system. We actually even know why. Virtualized systems allow you to run very, very scaled down versions of Linux. Linux has polling loops for device kernel modules. There are daemons that are running. You take all that stuff out, you can actually make it run a little faster in its memory partition than if you don't. So that was fascinating. We could see no performance difference except for this random file access. And a lot of people were talking to us about MPI, which is a networking technology. So what's the deal? Well, then we went off to look at what AWS does. AWS gives you VMs, single VM, 1.3 gigahertz of Xeon processor, 160 gig of disk, and I think 1.5 gig of memory, something like that, for 10 cents a CPU hour. But they don't charge you for the inner VM bandwidth. So what we did is we launched 1,000, over the course of about 3 weeks, 1,000 different VM-to-VM communication events. We would spin up two VMs. They would find each other by talking back to us. We would open a socket connection, communicate for 60 seconds. There's no charge for inner VM communication. Record the bandwidth, shut down. Do that 1,000 times. And I've plotted that for you in the leftmost column. That blue dot measures on the y-axis the number of megabits per second we observed. Okay? Looks like about 480. The thing that is hard to see from the back of the room in particular is that there are 95% confidence bounds on that little dot. You just can't see them because they're obscured by the dot. Very, very little variance, right? What does this mean? Well, it means that when you pay 10 cents a CPU hour and you don't pay anything for the network, you don't get a full gig E. And it's not contention. Contention would have way bigger error bars. Amazon's throttling the bandwidth. You're not paying for it. They don't promise you a gig E. They promise you some network connectivity. At the time we did the study, that's how much they gave us. It's not that the virtualization is slow. It's that you get what you pay for, right? On the right-hand side, the first green dot on the right-hand side is exactly the same experiment. We took the same AMI. We put it on a cluster in our environment. These are very old machines, some really old networking gear. And we did the same thing, 1,000 different trials, 95% confidence bounds. That's wire speed for gig E, right? The next blue dot, just in case you're interested, is availability zones. Amazon has this notion of separate data centers, and there is some sort of wide area thing going on. And you should expect to see a bit of drop in bandwidth, and you do. And then for us, you don't. That's layer 3 tunneling. We actually set up a layer 3 tunnel between these two racks that we had in our lab just to see how fast it would go. The thing that we're not telling you there is how much CPU it eats. Layer 3 tunneling can be expensive in terms of CPU, but you get full bandwidth. So it's not the virtualization, it's not the cloud, it's the rental. And you should know what you're doing. Just for completeness sake, this is round trip time with the 95% confidence bounds. And as you see, two availability zones, that's wide area. That's what you'd expect to see. What's a little strange is why the layer 3 tunnel is giving us such high variation on round trip time. We don't really understand this yet. This is open source stuff using VTUN. So we haven't pulled that code apart to figure out what's going on yet, but some work to do. And the last performance graph I'll show you is image starts. So what we did is we did 100 starts of 4 images per request and then just sorted them. This is an inverted CDF. So the way you read this is to say something like 60%, you go over to the 0.6 on the bottom, you say 60% of the image starts for eucalyptus, which is the bottom green line, took 10 seconds or less. Okay? And lower is better here. So what this means is that eucalyptus is starting up 4 instances faster than Amazon for the same instances. They're very small instances. We made this kind of like test instance, and it's tiny. Why is that? Does this mean that eucalyptus is faster than Amazon? No. Don't download eucalyptus and try to compete with Amazon. You can't do it. What this means, the thing to understand is the bottom graph, that green graph, was generated on a very small machine. It's got about 40 cores in it. It's probably about this big. The upper graph is what Amazon generates on a machine the size of North Dakota, right? That's really fast, really fast. The fact that we can show them on the same graph is remarkable. There are some very, very sophisticated placement algorithms going on inside Amazon. I don't know what they are, but we expected, just given the proximity and the size, that we would be much faster than Amazon, and that's really a triumph for them. The important thing from our perspective, though, is that the shape of those graphs is more or less the same. And what this says to us is that modulo scale, the underlying dynamics that are driving the variability, because there is some variability in all of this, is the same for Amazon and for us. We are using, in this example, we are using Zen, and we've tuned the system. That's good news. This basically means eucalyptus is not inherently broken. If you expose your graduate students for 5.5 months to this kind of insanity, it's nice if it's not broken. Okay, I will finish by telling you a little bit about what the community has done in response to all of this. These are monthly downloads. I apologize for not having the last couple of months. Totals since we started the project. We rolled our first release more or less June 1st of 2008. We have a release coming out on Thursday. The big jump there was both when we commercialized and we released the 1.5 version of eucalyptus, which had full networking support and multi-distro, full multi-distro support. So you can see a big jump there. But basically, that's good. That's a good uptake graph. This is an accident that we sort of turned into a Google graph. Last time we released software, time before last, we put out a version and people were saying, look, this is great. I stood it up, but I don't know if it's working. Can you give me an image to run? And we had these tiny little images that we were handing out. And say, yeah, run this. If it stands up, then it's working. Then people started saying, well, gee, that's nice, but I'd really like to have an Ubuntu image. And could you make sure it has Java installed? And so on and so forth. So we actually made up a little web page with images that are CentOS or Ubuntu or OpenSUSE or whatever. And they've got the basic stuff in them. So if you just want to stand up a eucalyptus cloud and then get a bunch of images and go, you can. People have to go to that web page, though, to figure out what's there and download it, and we get an IP address out of that access. So this is a month's worth of eucalyptus starts in July. We stood this thing up at the beginning of July, and a month later we looked, we figured this out, and the interesting thing from our perspective is twofold. One, during the month of July, nothing happened in Antarctica involving eucalyptus, and two, somebody in the northern part of Greenland I'm sorry, in the northern part of Iceland is using eucalyptus, and we'd love to know what they're using it for. But anyway, lots of response in Europe, lots of response in Asia. This is what open source is like. Here's the Linux part. We made the decision early on to make it distro neutral. It's funny, the distros didn't make the decision to make us distro neutral. And so the first one to come to us was Ubuntu. They said, look, we think this is great. And furthermore, in case you haven't figured it out, what we do as Ubuntu is we try to bring to the Linux community the disruptive technologies, the technologies that we think are really going to change the way Linux works before our competitors. Right? All of the Linux distros have sort of a niche, and they sort of tout these niches. This is the one that Ubuntu fulfills, is the idea that it's as rapid as Debian, but as supportable as Red Hat, if you're into this kind of thing. And so they said, we think this is really an important technology. Can you package Eucalyptus for Ubuntu? It's got to use KVM, because Ubuntu is now KVM, no Xen. And there's some packaging issues that we want you to solve. And so we did that. We rolled out a version for their Jaunty Jackalope release, which was April 23rd, that had those things in it. And they said, wow, that's really great. Except we'd like to base our next release, Karmic Koala, essentially on Eucalyptus itself. And so we're going to name it Karmic Koala. That came out October 23rd. Boy, it was a tough 6 months, believe me, because they wanted all these enhancements. They wanted scalability enhancements and separated components and multiple clusters and management and all this kind of stuff, because they really feel like this is where Linux is going. So we went there with them and rolled that out. They've got an ecosystem that you can just unpack from Ubuntu around Eucalyptus called the Ubuntu Enterprise Cloud. There's an app store, there's some power management, there's some new documentation, just stuff you need to make it easier. And the weird thing about this from our perspective is starting on the 23rd, it's in main, which means that when you get an automatic update from Ubuntu, you get a Eucalyptus. That's 10 million downloads, right, on day one. That's a lot of downloads for us. There you go. We've been going through that. We will roll with the next release, 10.04, Lucid Lynx, I believe it's called, in April, and it'll have some enhancements. So we plan to continue with our Ubuntu partners. But we're also working with the Debian people. We think it'll be in Squeeze. Squeeze busted Xen and has a broken version of KVM at the moment. So you can't actually test it with Squeeze, which is really frustrating, because it's packaged for Squeeze. If you're not familiar with this, Debian goes through these very, very long experimental cycles between releases. So we think it'll be in Squeeze. We have packaged it for CentOS ourselves, for OpenSUSE. What this means is that we'll run with CentOS or RHEL, or OpenSUSE or SLES. We're talking to the SUSE people about whether they want to distribute it as well. And we've had conversations with the Red Hat people. I'm not sure where that's going yet. So the bottom line is we're trying to make this available through the Linux community, and so far we've had some success. There's a bit of an ecosystem that's surrounding Eucalyptus. This is how you can tell, another way you can tell if you're succeeding. These are companies or projects that have announced that they are supporting Eucalyptus as a technology. Right. So RightScale, this is a company that makes this really wonderful dashboard. That Animoto example that Werner showed is really a RightScale Amazon example. The RightScale people built this Ruby-based control platform for Amazon's AWS, and those guys in the coffee shops are actually much more comfortable with a GUI than they were with the Amazon tools. So it's just wonderful. That technology is great. We went to them and said, you know, it's so great. Could you just point it at this Eucalyptus cluster and tell us if you can tell the difference? The answer is they can't. Right? So that was our Turing test. They worked with us on that. Cohesive FT is another platform. Nebula, this is NASA. NASA has built a cloud that they call Nebula. It's Eucalyptus, RabbitMQ, and Lustre. And Vivek Kundra, the CTO of the universe, or at least of North America, has come out and laid his hands on it, and apparently this is a good thing. So we're seeing some uptake in the government. And the last thing I'll point to is AppScale. There's another researcher at UCSB, Chandra Krentz, who I had the misfortune of sitting down and kind of helping me work through some of the intellectual challenges associated with subjecting your students to something like this. And through the course of those conversations, she decided to do what we did for Eucalyptus, only to do it for Google's App Engine. So you can go to her website, download GAE open source. It uses lots of different backends, runs on top of Eucalyptus. What this means is you can actually run in your data center something today that is both Amazon's AWS and GAE. That's never going to happen in the wild, ever. So that's cool. That's a great research platform. It's experimental. I mean, the question is, okay, what if your applications did some GAE and some AWS at the same time? I don't know. Interesting. So that's happened. Here's just kind of the roadmap. You're actually not there. You're one bullet down. On Thursday, are going to release essentially our distro-neutral version of what came out in Karmic. It's got some bug fixes and a couple of extra features, but more or less it's the same thing as Karmic. And as far as we know, it basically finishes off the AWS language specification or API specification as of the first of this year, really as of March of this year. They've been adding features to AWS. Some of these features we're looking at, some of them don't really make sense to us as actually cloud features. So this is basically EC2, S3, and EBS. Dynamic DNS, all the virtual bucket naming, authentication and digital signature stuff that you need to pull this off. And the goal there is really just this low-level IaaS transparency. We'll probably roll one more bug fix release by the end of the year. We get a lot of interest in people contributing to the core, to actual functions that run the cloud. This is tricky. We've been releasing software about once every 6 weeks. And if you're in another country and you've built a bunch of web services that we can't do QA on, by the time we get them, we've rolled our software forward. So we really tried to hold the community off until this time. We'll probably go to a 6-month release cycle just after the first of the year. I'm hoping we will. And then be able to ingress a lot more of the community's contributions to the core itself. People are contributing things that run on top of Eucalyptus all the time, but a lot of people who want to get in there and really change the way the keys are managed. I don't understand that. But there you go. A little bit. Now, this is the only marketing part. I apologize. But I'm here because they make it possible. It turns out that you can't do any of this as a research project, right? You can do the initial thing, and you can write some papers about it, but interacting with the open source community at whatever time of night it is, dealing with the Linux community and making the stuff packageable and doing the QA, and then really interacting with companies. We started getting phone calls from these very large companies saying, look, we're running Eucalyptus in our data center right now, and we need your help. How do we pay you? And the answer is, as a college professor, you can't, right? I can't take researchers and turn them on a 15-minute basis or half-hour basis into consultants and then back into researchers again. There's IP problems. There's moral and ethical questions. You just can't do it. So along about the early part of this year, we had struggled with this about as long as I knew how to struggle with it, and said, look, okay, either we're just going to put this out and walk away from it and go back to doing research, or we've got to commercialize. And so we did. We took the latter, went out and got some VC funding, and then just called up a bunch of the companies that were trying to do business with us when we were university people and said, okay, we're ready. And that business takes two forms in the early phases, and we're just about out of that early phase. We offered services. If you want to run the open source Eucalyptus, but you want to talk to the people who know how to make it work in your environment, you can call us, and we charge you a fee for that. What that mostly does, though, is allow us to learn from you what it is Eucalyptus does not do, right? Because we've put it out and it does a lot of things, but in a data center context, in a commercial context, there's a lot of things it doesn't do. We have learned that now. And those things we're rolling out as products, which we charge a fee for. So we have a set of products that enhance the open source core that are not open source. The first we announced is support for VMware, right? It supports Xen and KVM, both open source hypervisors, just fine. But if you're going to go off and buy a license and run a data center on a proprietary hypervisor like VMware, then no reason that our software shouldn't be considered part of that infrastructure. You can buy that from us. Other things we'll be coming out with probably the first of the year is HA. Eucalyptus has individual components. If the machine goes down, it's crash consistent, but your cloud stops. We have an HA framework that we're working on that will keep the cloud running, much like Amazon. Storage architecture integration stuff, we can drill it into your SANs now. The open source stuff uses a local file system. All these things that we can sell you to make it more amenable to the data center, but as an open source experimental platform for you to get your hands wet, it's going to be there. We're going to continue to maintain it. That's its purpose. We're not backing away from that. And lastly, I'll stop by saying thank you to the people who sponsored this project. The first organization that needs credit here is the University of California, Santa Barbara. It is impossible, absolutely impossible, both from a logistical perspective and essentially from a legal perspective, to do something like this from a publicly funded research university. It's just hard, right? And if you don't have the full support of your department and your university, isn't going to happen. Now, the good news is that UCSB is really forward-thinking, and they understand this is having societal impact. There are people all over the world now, today, whose lives are somewhat better because we have done this, and UCSB deserves the credit for that, and they should be given it. Also, the National Science Foundation, through the VGrads project, they paid for this. You have to pay the students, you have to pay the programmers, the postdocs, and so on and so forth. We did this under the umbrella of a large-scale, five-year-long research effort in distributed systems, which was grid-based. And we demonstrated Eucalyptus and grid systems working together on a legacy Fortran code at SC last year, so they got their money's worth, but they certainly funded the initial development. Past about May 1st of this year, though, we kind of moved on to other funding sources who have slightly different focus, it seems, and they are Benchmark and BV Capital. They're really nice. It's a little bit more intense than we're used to, but certainly deserve the credit for having faith in us to try to make a go of it as a commercial endeavor. I will stop there. You've been extremely patient. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'll take them now.
Hey, Rich. I'm Jay Faulkner with Rackspace Email and Apps.
Hi, Jay.
I was just going to ask, why is it that it was important to open source an implementation of a cloud like this?
Yeah.
But yet there's not an open standard being developed around it, and instead you're tying yourself to something proprietary.
Yeah, this comes up all the time. Okay, and it's really two excellent questions. Okay, the first is, why was it important to put the software out as open source? We think it's important not only because we personally have benefited from open source infrastructure in terms of being able to explore what is possible, but also looking at the way data centers are built today and where innovation comes from, it's really from open source. It's not exclusively from open source, but a lot of what drives the next technology cycle in these spaces has come from some sort of open source project, JBoss or Spring or whatever you want. Okay, so we really felt like innovation is going to come from open source. Now, second question is about standards and whether it's an open standard or not. And I think this question is a valid question. Let me give you my experience. I've been involved with three standards efforts in my life. And two things have stood out to me as a result of those efforts. The first is, if you standardize too early, you're making a mistake. You will stifle innovation, right? Because people are deathly afraid to try something that they don't, that they know will not be supported in the future. And if it's not written in the standard, they don't think it's going to be supported. The second thing that I learned is the technologists at the beginning of a technology should never be allowed to participate in standards. And that's because we all, myself included, have a tremendous personal advantage if our approach is adopted as a standard. If I sit on a standard body, and really, I've done this as an academic, you should not trust a thing I say. Because even without the company, if you adopt Eucalyptus as a standard, my career is set. I have a huge conflict of interest, if I try to tell you what to do in your standard. So I won't. We sit on no standards body for this reason. At some point, users, people who actually use the cloud, will begin demanding features of all clouds. When that happens, you put those users into the standards process and you make them run it. Then we technologists, we have to listen to what the users do want and what the users do not want. And what the users do want are the standards. It will work brilliantly that way. We are not there yet because the technology is so new. And lastly, I think you might be asking a question about whether there's a risk associated with taking an API that has been documented every which way from Sunday for the purposes of allowing interoperability and building a system that uses that documentation to promote interoperability. And I would say no. It's the shortest answer you'll get out of me. Sorry. Go ahead.
Hi, Rich. Brendan Quinn from Yahoo. I'd like you to talk a little bit about eventual consistency.
Sure.
There are implications of the eventual consistency model on the operational side, including but not limited to time to recovery after failure, how you measure what the time to consistency is, and other things like that. So I'd be interested in hearing what you think the challenges are with that model and how you may have solved some of them.
Oh, that's a fabulous question. Yeah, eventual consistency. First, let me define it for those of you who are not familiar with it. What eventual consistency says is that when you store something into persistent store, there's no guarantee about when it is you will read back what it is you have stored. Eventually, you will. But you're not sure of when that is. And the reason for that is scale, right? If I write into a bucket in Seattle, and then someone in Singapore reads a bucket and a replica had been made of the old bucket, they're going to read the old copy. Eventually, that bucket will get propagated. Amazon doesn't tell you when that is going to be the case. I think it is possible, it's tricky, but it's possible to put an SLA, a service level agreement, an honest to goodness service level agreement, on the consistency semantics. And the trade-off you're going to make is a scale trade. Right? You can see this kind of today with EBS. If you're not familiar with Amazon, you get something called Elastic Block Store, which looks like an attached disk. You can format it or whatever, but it only lives in one availability zone. And essentially, and only one VM can attach to it, but when you write and read it, you get a consistent picture. What you wrote is what you're going to read back. It just doesn't scale across availability zones. So there's a trade-off. There's a trade-off between how long you want eventual to be and how much scale you want to take advantage of in your application. And you can make that trade-off today by choosing one of two storage paradigms in Amazon. It's a simple matter to add, well, not a simple matter. It is possible to add either abstractions or SLAs that say, look, I want this much eventual consistency. I'm willing to pay this much for it. And I realize I'm going to sacrifice some amount of replication in order to be able to get that bound on when the consistency will happen. And statistically speaking, I think that's a tractable problem.
Thank you.
It's a great question.
Quick question. You talked quite a bit about SLAs and so on and so forth. Do you have anything in area of SLAs in terms of network and storage, in terms of what resources they can get? I'm talking about, you know, segregated bandwidths and segregated storage pools and so on and so forth. And also, like, you know, the VLANs are kind of yesterday's technology, right? So you do anything new in there? Or?
Yeah, okay. Good question. So the first question about do we do anything with SLAs? And the answer is not yet, other than to allow you to lay Eucalyptus on top of whatever infrastructure you've got. So if you've got a SAN and you know what the SLA is for that SAN, we will allow you to attach that SAN to EBS, particular EBS storage controller, so that the SLAs from that SAN come through that volume manager, right? And then when your users request volumes from that EBS, they'll get the SLAs from the SAN. The beauty of Amazon is it doesn't get in your way, right? It sets things up and then it stands back. And so once you've done the configuration, the actual data path is unperturbed by anything Amazon does or anything we do. That's not strictly true for Amazon, but that's how we've been approaching it. And we have experimented with things like programming the Cisco switch. iOS is not very programmable from an automatic perspective, but you can do it. And we have. I don't recommend this. But the bottom line is if you allow Eucalyptus to program your network environment, we can do whatever it is your administrators do through automatic methods. It's just that you may be unhappy with the results. However, I think this is something where we are going to innovate. We know an awful lot from our grid days about how to do online statistical analysis of performance response and reliability, to the point where we actually built a system that did statistical reservations out of very, very badly behaved data, very unreliable data. And so, again, I think these are tractable problems if you know how to attack them properly. And we certainly plan to, but others will as well. The thing to understand, though, is that the SLA is going to come from the infrastructure itself and what the infrastructure supports. And what the cloud does is provide a way for the users to manipulate that provisioning, and then it, if it's doing its job properly, will stand back and allow the usage to be unfettered. So that SLA will come through to the user. Thank you all very, very much for your attention.